Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for April 7th, 2022, in the ongoing series of this year, 2022, dedicated to the history of my discoveries and a lot of anecdotes also dealing with all of the things that happened. Last month, March, the five programs were dedicated to what I call the Cornell years. And I want to do a little bit of a summary here as to the things that happened. And one thing it did is it really changed the scientific community because they began to hoard data, something that they really weren't aware of, that somebody would come from within their ranks, literally, to take the information and find something different. That was something they just never even conceived of. The situation was that the data would come in, and it was really open at the time. And as I had talked about, I'd go up to the after classes in the afternoon, go up to the big auditorium up in the Space Science Building, and that's where the data would come in, this huge screen, big screen TV. And this is 1979, before any of you had big screen TVs. They had it was more like a projection TV, but the data would come in. And I realized that these NASA scientists really had no clue of what was going on. But as they were shocked that somebody would take this same data and interpret it differently and basically say everything that they were doing was wrong, this shocked them. And their reaction was to give the principal investigators the data to manipulate, etc. And of course, I was asking for raw data because I was used to seeing raw data. What did the instrument actually do? What did the instrument actually say? And you have to understand that the spacecraft were not properly designed in the first place. As I've said, they were trying to do things like particle measurements. That's very common, or magnetic field measurements. And how can you do that with a single point of reference spacecraft? Well, you can't. But there's things you can tell about it when there's rapid changes, for example. For example, if all of the particle detectors go off scale at the same time, before the spacecraft can charge, it actually takes a little bit of time. So you see this huge influx, for example, of electrons, and then all of a sudden it balances out. Well, you know that that influx did not stop. You're in a big current stream. That stream did not stop. Or, for example, when the Giotto spacecraft flew in front of Halley's Comet, it just got torqued. It was gyrostabilized, and so it got completely turned off of its axis. It got thrown. The electron detectors and the magnetic sensors went completely off scale. Very clearly, they were going right through the electron beam that I had predicted. And, of course, the dirty snowball comet model has no explanation for that. It took them a number of weeks to regain communication with the Giotto spacecraft. And all this time, the Giotto spacecraft was taking data, and then they were able to extract that data. But that data then stays with the principal investigators, who then throw it away because they favor the dirty snowball comet model. And so anyway, the axioms of astronomy that all of these NASA scientists would adhere to, and by religion, by edict, and if they stepped outside this bound, they would be fired. They did not have an option to step outside that. So when I would request data, they'd say, well, the principal investigators have 2 months or 3 months when only they can see the data, and then they'll release it. Well, of course, they're going to release the manipulated, massaged, homogenized, and blended data, not the data, the raw data, and I would insist on the raw data. And no, they wouldn't do that. Then it would be 6 months. Then it would be 9 months. Then it would be a year. And they just kept putting it off, and then finally they just wouldn't write back. And, of course, this data does not belong to NASA. It belongs to the public. But anyway, this is one of the big changes that occurred. And then when, for example, we'll get into this later, around the 19, 91 period of time when the CIA came in and took over NASA, lock, stock, and barrel. Dan Golden was brought out of the CIA by George Bush Sr. as he handed the presidency off to his old drug-dealing buddy, Billy Clinton. They brought in Dan Golden from the CIA to take over NASA and shut it down. So these are all the changes that took place because they were becoming very paranoid. And, of course, the 1979-81 era when I was at Cornell was post-Apollo because NASA had already learned how to lie. Never a straight answer was already their nickname. That's one very important big change. The other big change was that it caused them to go into hiding even more. And something that happened was that at that point, NASA scientists could no longer walk up to the microphone and give an opinion because a lot of times they would make a mistake. And so you started seeing the control of the news media. And by the time I give this example, in 1986, I was at a American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco, and Jonathan Eberhardt was there. And he was an editor, a journalist from Science News. He wrote an article that was favorable, actually mentioned to me, and he just got lambasted. So, and because he had mentioned my name, and the reason I know this is I called him up one day, said, "Jonathan, how's it going?" And he was really angry. He said, "Don't ever call me again. Don't ever talk to me." He said, you know, he basically told me he was threatened and that his position as a journalist was threatened and because of writing an article about me. So they were very, very conscious of who I was. I'll tell another little story. Actually, this is about Dan Golden. This is going into the future quite a ways. It was in the early 2000s, and I got called by a local news media outlet and a local group to do a video for local cable TV. And so we went into the studio, and we had kind of a gallery of people who they were from various groups, intellectual groups around the Twin Cities. And so probably about 30, I would estimate maybe 30 people, maybe 40 in this gathering. And it was talking in the early days of Planet X, and my book Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes had just come out. And so anyway, the producer on this, working in the studio, and it was a real studio we went into, very nicely equipped studio for local cable TV. And the producer was Tony Scarpelli. Now, Tony was a volunteer for this. He volunteered for the local, to do these specials for the local TV out of general interest. So anyway, he was a producer. And then he became interested in my work, etc., just casually, not as a fan or, you know, anything like that, but just a casual interest in my work. So he was aware of the books, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, and my early books, etc. And Tony was a prize-winning electrical engineer, not just any prize, but he won the annual IEEE Electrical Engineer of the Year Award, and this is early 2000s. And to give the honorarium speech was Dan Golden from NASA. Dan Golden came to give Tony this award. So this is a big national award with a banquet and people attending from all over the country. And this was, Tony worked for a small company in Minneapolis, an electronics company, and I believe they made modems and Ethernet equipment, etc. So anyway, Tony gets the award, and Dan Golden is glowing accolades over Tony's work. Dan Golden gives the speech, and of course, after the speech and after the supper, they get to talk person to person. So they're talking, and everything is going great. And Tony, who was the producer on this show, who ran the cameras and produced and edited the show for cable TV, And by the way, as a result of that, I was on cable TV, and I couldn't go into a grocery store without some little kid going, "Mom, there's the guy from TV, you know, the Planet X guy." So anyway, and then this aired on national cable TV also. But anyway, so Tony Scarpelli, engineer of the Electrical Engineer of the Year Award, and Dan Golden, the head of NASA, who came in, like I say, from the CIA to put the lid on NASA, are talking. And so they're talking, and Tony says, have you ever heard of James McCanney? And Tony told me about this himself. He said Dan Golden's face turned red, and it got scrinkled up like a prune and all contorted. And Dan Golden said, no comment. That was the only thing he could say, because that's the only thing he was allowed to say. And then Tony, not really realizing this, pushed it farther. And he says, well, he has a lot of books on Planet X. He's very famous. Have you heard of James McCanney and his work? And he said Dan Golden's face became more contorted. And he said no comment, and he turned and he walked away. 2 weeks later, Tony Scarpelli was fired from his job without cause. This is the bizarre nature of the science world that came out of the Cornell years. And I could give story after story after story about these kind of things happening, where scientists were simply, they could not talk about it, the ones that knew about it. And so anyway, these are some major effects. So clearly, I had a stunning effect on the scientific world, and this is tier two. The other thing that happened is that I was contacted occasionally by what I learned would be tier one science, and I became involved in tier one science myself. I'll be talking about that a little bit later in this show today, about my magnetic propulsion systems, presenting these to venture capital groups in Los Angeles, meeting tier one physicists in these meetings to vet my work, etc., before they invested in it, etc. And so anyway, I got to know the people in tier one science. I was invited to Los Alamos National Laboratory to talk. I was invited to Airspace America to talk. I was invited to international electric propulsion conferences that were closed military tier one meetings, etc. And so my life took a twist, and I never signed any documents with tier one science. I never signed any documents with the government. I was always an independent scientist. But everybody knew me, and I think that's the one thing that probably stands out in all of this. But one thing very interesting was that as graduate students would come up in university settings, they didn't teach them anything about this, so they were green behind the ears, and this led to some very funny situations. For example, when Michael Brown is the guy who accidentally, through a computer search, accidentally found the first Kuiper Belt object called Sedna, and with a automated computer search, and then he, of course, became famous immediately. I think he worked in one of the California universities as an astronomer. And so he was on an interview one day, and I was listening to this on the radio live, and he was talking about Sedna and the fact that they thought it was ice-covered. And so, of course, they knew the orbit of Sedna, and it was not something that would come into the inner solar system or anything. But anyway, the Reuters journalist stood up and asked the following question. He said, what if this would come into the inner solar system? Is there any danger of this? Because clearly the announcement of this was going to lead to more discoveries of this type, but this was the very first one. And of course, thousands and thousands of these planets would be discovered in the next few years by these same search engines, automated telescopic searches. So Michael Brown, in response to the Reuters journalist question of what would happen if this came into the solar system, he blurts out, well, this would be the biggest comet that anybody ever saw. You know, and in those few words stated exactly Velikovsky's work in a nutshell, that planets could come in and become comets and be planets, planetary size. And so the backpedaling was immediate. Oh, well, he didn't really mean that, you know, and but I mean, the as they say, the cat's out of the bag. The toothpaste is out of the toothpaste tube. You can't get it back in, and certainly not in a neat way. Let's just put it that way. So all of these things happened. And then, of course, the one solidifying force behind standard science and astronomy was Carl Sagan's Cosmos series that happened during that same time frame. It was released in 1981 for public consumption. So, I mean, these Cornell years were filled with events that solidified the future of astronomy and the future of what you were able to hear and see. And, of course, 10 years later, 1989, the official discovery of Planet X occurred under a contract for NASA. NASA, as early as these years also, the early 1980s, Tom Van Flandern was working as assistant to Robert Harrington in the Naval Observatory. And Tom Van Flandern was interested in this idea of another planet out there, because the searches for post-Pluto planets had been going on literally since the 1700s. Uranus had been discovered, and it turned out that that was not the planet they were looking for. Then Neptune was discovered. That was not the planet they were looking for. In fact, they realized that those two planets were being pulled by a third planet. And then you had Pluto, which was discovered in the 1930s by Clyde, the astronomer, famous, Clyde Tomlinson, I believe it was last name. No, it's Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered the Pluto, and realized right away, and Robert Harrington was instrumental in that a later discovery, that Pluto had a moon. But they already knew, as soon as they did some calculations, they knew that Pluto was not the 10th planet they were looking for either. And so Pluto became a planet. And it was Robert Harrington, in his youth, that was part of the discovery that Pluto had a companion moon. And they were able to determine the orbital properties and therefore the mass of Pluto, realizing that it was very small. Certainly not the Planet X, that comet object that they were looking for. And then Harrington went on to discover, and much of this at the behest of astronomer Tom Van Flandern, that they were looking for this other planet. And then, because Pluto and Uranus and Neptune were being pulled down in their orbits, they realized it was somewhere down there, and they did calculations, etc. Eventually, Harrington discovered this. And so anyway, there again, you have this object coming into the solar system that's big. And I'll be talking a lot about this. If you want to get a prelude to this, read my book, Planet X, Update 2020, The Real Story of Planet X. That's a book that's essential for you to read to understand that. You may as well do that right now. And by the way, you should be reading all of my books, from Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, all the way up through all of the books as part of this lecture series. Do not depend, and I will repeat this, do not depend on these lectures as some kind of statement of my work. That is an error, because I'm just talking about the history of these discoveries. Last week I did a summary of the discoveries that I made. Each one of those could develop into a semester or two semester long university level or graduate level course. And so by no means is this a statement of my work. It's a statement of the historical development in the order of discoveries, etc., that I made. And so just let me make that perfectly clear, because there might be some people out there that think, oh, I'll just listen to this and then I'll know what McCanny's work is all about. No, this is simply about the history and the order, putting this into a chronological order of discoveries and the importance of the timing of these and what was going around in history during this time. But back to the Carl Sagan Cosmos series, solidifying everything that astronomy had to be into the future. That was reiterated by Neil deGrasse Tyson a number of years ago, where they redid the Cosmos series. And then this became the standard story that everybody had to follow in standard astronomy. And of course, it's all completely wrong. Everything Carl Sagan did was wrong. Unbelievable. But it set the direction, so that too came out of this time period, because when I was at Cornell, Carl Sagan was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. So all of this happened in those 2 years. Very fundamental to understand the importance of those 2 years, 1979 to 81. And so when Robert Harrington discovered the Planet X object, for which he was under contract to NASA, and that's when the CIA came in and took over NASA, when he finally made the final discovery and made the determination of orbit of Planet X. This is 1991, so I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but it's important to understand this. And CIA is in taking over the Naval Observatory and NASA, etc. About 2 months later, Robert Harrington dies a mysterious death, because I think he was going to go public. But the original orbit, which I later took me a decade or more to figure out, I already had a suspicion, but the object that Harrington discovered became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. So here you had a planet-sized object coming into the solar system. It was on a near collision course with Earth when he first discovered it, and that's why all of the big to-do about this in the CIA is to make sure that nobody in the astronomy community announced this and to the public, to cause a public panic, because the CIA is in control and they want to make sure they are in total control of the information that gets to the public. So anyway, the nucleus of Planet X, or the Planet X objects, which had a companion, so they knew the mass. If it has a companion, you can calculate the mass. So they knew the mass of this object coming in on a direct collision course with Earth. And in 1995, it explodes into a comet, which was discovered by Hale and Bopp, so-called Comet Hale-Bopp. But the thing was that the tail drag, unbeknownst to the CIA or their less than intelligent scientists, the tail drag was going to cause it to slow down in its orbit dramatically. And so Earth moved out of the way, out of harm's way, basically. We were over three months advanced in our orbit by the time Hale-Bopp came near to where Earth was supposed to be. And so anyway, once again, to get the details on this, my book, Planet X 2020, the Real History of Planet X, that's the book that it's called, Planet X 2020 Update, The Real History of Planet X, continues with that topic, but and all of the things that went on then. So I'm going to mention a few other things here. I mentioned Tony Scarpelli with Dan Golden, no comment. There was an exact same situation that occurred. They, I won't say exactly how this happened, but they sent a CIA agent out to compromise me. That's all I'm going to say. And it did not work out in their favor. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all of the details, but this person then became an informant for me, and I got them to go into JPL and talk to the scientists in JPL, and they got the same thing. This person asked scientists, NASA scientists in JPL, if they'd ever heard of James McCanny. And they responded exactly the same. No comment. And then when pressed again to, have you ever heard about James McCanny or his work? The answer came back, no comment. And so it's very interesting because you see that the negative garbage against me on the internet does not come from NASA. It comes from their outreach agents who are supposedly these independent scientists that only do this for their own well-being or on their own volition, which is not true. They're getting paid under the table, and all the trolls, we call them trolls, internet trolls, or just the other places where you might see my name trashed, etc., are paid. They are paid under the table from the CIA, and they have handlers. So at any rate, interesting that this person that I got to go into JPL and ask the same question got the same comment or say the same response, no comment. I'll just give you a couple other examples that these are all in the future, because right now I should be talking about 1981, literally, as I left Cornell, and I'll get into that. But I'm just setting the stage here for what's to come. I'm at an American Geophysical Union meeting. This is in around probably the late 1990s. And I have a poster session which says in big letters, "Comets are not dirty snowball." And it's kind of an in-your-face type of, in fact, I think you can see that on my webpage. Yes, I do sell that as part of my poster, the three poster set. And the Michael Muma, who was a big shot at Goddard at the time, comes up and confronts me, really angry. And interestingly enough, he has a whole entourage of what appear to be graduate students. You can tell graduate students; they're dressed rather sloppily. You know, they're poor. You look at their shoes. Their shoes are usually worn-out tennis shoes. These are not people that are gainfully employed, but clearly they're with badges, et cetera, associated with universities. So these are grad students primarily, and there's about 15 of them standing back there, probably about 30 feet away, and Michael Muma comes up, and he confronts me. And he says, "We don't like what you're doing. You shouldn't be doing this." And I said, "Oh, yeah, that's right. You're only supposed to take an article that's already been published and add a little bit to it, and that's how you should publish articles." He was really mad, and I basically told him to, well, I won't say on this radio, but I had a curt comment for him, and then he backed off and went away. But interesting, he wanted to show off that he was in control of me, and he found out very quickly that he wasn't. And then there was another incident. There was a young physicist who took an interest in my work that I was doing, and this was at another American Geophysical Union meeting. And this person had just gotten a PhD from Azerbaijan, off of one of the Eastern European countries, and was talking to me and the handler. Now, these people all have handlers at NASA when they come over and start doing work with the United States, etc. And so the handler comes in and takes this person and walks away immediately, just drags this person away. Another one was interesting, where I had a group of, these were graduate students, they came and they were very interested in a poster I was doing on the electrical conditions above volcanoes. This was at a American Geophysical Union meeting. And so anyway, their handler comes up to me and starts arguing, "Well, this is not true, you don't need to, the lightning around a volcano is caused by the upsurge of hot gases in the volcano." And the student points out and says, "But the lightning is outside of the cloud. And that's an indication that the lightning is not produced inside the cloud, because if it were inside the cloud, all of the discharges would remain inside the cloud, where the least resistance would be. the fact that the lightning is coming from outside the cloud into the cloud is very clear indication of exactly what I'm saying, is that it's discharging the vertical electric field. And the student says this, and the professor got really mad and then also dragged them away. This is the condition that you're dealing with in education. These are people getting PhDs in garbage science. So anyway, getting back to the 1979-81 Cornell years, this sets the stage and splits science. One is the Carl Sagan Cosmos series, standard science, you got to do it this way or you don't get to do anything. You are fired and out of there, so you have to maintain this way, this information, whether you like it or not. And then there's my half of the science world, in which I'm off doing my own thing and very clearly correct, because the tier one scientists are coming out and they're telling me, said, yeah, you're doing everything right. And so they have learned a lot from what I do. Anyway, I wanted to kind of recap those two Cornell years because they're so crucial in understanding what happened and all the way up to today. When you see journal articles or like space.com or something saying, oh, yes, comets are these little dirty snowballs, icy wanderers. They have about a dozen terms they throw in there. And then they have these little videos with these they call them journalists. People have gone to journalism school and they know enough to repeat what they're told. No questions asked. Just one more story here, and this is a good one, because this was the one of the American Geophysical Union meetings dealing with comets. And so NASA started having closed news release sessions. And so they go up to this room, and only NASA scientists can be in it, in the news release. The public's not allowed. And so I was going up the elevator and I was going to just stand outside the door and listen if I could. Well, of course, they had closed the doors, but I get in the elevator and there's a journalist in there and he's on his way up and he was from the New York Times. So I said, ask this question. And it was a pointed question about comets, which would be right in the face of the NASA scientists. And so anyway, he did. And he got fired. He got fired for asking the question that I feel sorry for the guy, but he probably didn't know what he was getting into. But that just gives you a level of protectionism that's going on in sciences and it's still going on today. Okay, in other words, the good, what they call it, that one old Western was called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I think this is, science is a very excellent case of that. Okay, so I'm going to start talking about the future now, and leaving Cornell was a bizarre experience in itself. So this is the last few weeks of school of the spring semester, 1981. I already know that things are not going well. I'm called into the head of the mathematics department office, and I've already talked about this. I'll just be brief, recount it again, that Wolfgang Fuchs, a wonderful man, very gentle, good mathematician. And he says, James, I don't know what to do. He says, your teaching is great. The students love you. They want you to teach their classes. He showed me this is the first time I saw the petition that the students had brought to him, 395 names on it. And these were like notebook pages torn out of notebooks, of student notebooks with names, signing this petition. Three of that was from the calculus class that I had taken over, and the students wanted me to teach their class. And he had these pages on his desk. And I, up to that point, I didn't know that that happened. But at any rate, he says, the students love you. They want you to teach their class. You know, all your, all of your credentials here are great. We like you here. He said, you're the only faculty Department of Mathematics at Cornell University and the History of Cornell that has published in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. So this is, amazing, but they want me to fire you. And he said, they're putting a lot of pressure on him to get rid of me. And so anyway, he said, well, I'll have to make a decision and then you'll find out. Well, I found out that, needless to say, I didn't get renewed, let's put it that way. And so anyway, that day I knew that, I had a few weeks left there and that I had just been railroaded by a bunch of criminal scientists. And so I went back to where I was staying, and I had I was staying in a house in Ithaca, and I didn't realize this. Typically, the houses in Ithaca are big, so the wooden doors, etc., are big and heavy. It's real old construction. Somebody had put a thin pane glass window in the window, and I mistakenly pushed on that. That thing came apart in a million pieces and it cut my arm, my right arm, to the bone, and the glass had hit it, and literally cut through the muscle, everything right down to the bone, and then it started squirting blood all over the place. There was one vein that was like sticking out, and it was going whoosh, whoosh. It was like a garden hose with blood coming out. So I ran up the stairs, and there's blood everywhere. And I got up the stairs, and Matt was there, one of the guys living in the upstairs of this house where I was staying. And I wrapped a towel around my arm, and I said, come on, I got to go to the hospital. So this is late in the afternoon. It's probably 4 or 5 o'clock. And the way Ithaca is situated, the hospital they put on the outside of town, but you have to cross this bridge, a narrow bridge, and all the traffic funnels through that, and a lot of people live out there. So I'm in rush hour traffic. I'm driving my car, and I'm trying to weave through traffic and honking the horn, and the towel is already saturated with blood. And I get across the bridge, and I can see the hospital in the distance, and I fall out of the driver's seat unconscious. And I'm on the floor. So Matt, who was with me, luckily, gets in the driver's seat and was able to function and drive my car up to the hospital. And I kind of remember them hauling me out of the vehicle in a wheelchair and into the hospital, and they got blood into me in time, and I lived through this. But this is, so things were not going too well. Let's just put it this way. So they patched me up. I was in the hospital a couple days, put a cast on my arm. This is my right arm, which I use. So I finished off the year, and then I realized, okay, I can't stay in Ithaca anymore. I don't have an income. I have limited amount of resources. So I packed up and I returned to the Midwest. And this was a time when I really had to reflect and get things back together, because here I know I'm sitting on top of probably at least a dozen Nobel Prize winning discoveries. I'm publishing in journals. I'm getting blackballed by NASA scientists and the hierarchy in astronomy, and they're going all out. They go after your income, they go after your ability to publish, they go after everything, and so you will never surface again. Well, little did they know. They didn't understand me. So I got back to the Midwest and went up into Canada. I had some friends that were buying into a mining claim in Canada. And so I provided part of the funding to do that. You think, wow, buying a mining claim costs a lot of money. Not really. My contribution at the time in those dollars, 1981 dollars, was $1,400. And so anyway, I became part of this ability to go into Canada. And it was an amazing, amazing country, because a lot of times mining claims are out in the middle of the wilderness. And so then I had to regain my strength, because I was a bit weak just from being a working so much, sitting down and that type of book work, so to speak. And my right arm was pretty much useless because it cut the tendons, it cut the nerves, it cut everything for my part of my right hand. And so I remember the day I cut the cast off, and my hand was all shriveled up. If you ever had a cast on, you know what that's like. There was no strength to it. And if you've ever been in the wilderness, one of the main things you have to do is use a chainsaw. You have to use equipment because you're in the woods, you know, cutting firewood, etc. So it took a number of months, and then I went on a canoe trip up in central Canada. I went with this group of people who were very excellent woodsmen. And we went on one of the cross-Canadian river systems. And that's where my 10 months in the wilderness started. And we, catching fish, like basically you live on fish. Because in Canada, you can just throw a lure in the water and the fish come up, two or three or four of them come up at one time to get your lure. That's how good the fishing is there. So finding food is not a problem with berries and other natural food, and then you carry some rice and some other things with you. But anyway, by the end of the summer, I was able to hold the chainsaw out with one arm. This is a big chainsaw, still 041 chainsaw. Hold it out with my right arm and cut a branch off a tree. So I had regained all my strength canoeing and drinking fresh water every day, and that's part of it also, is the water there is so pure, you just take a cup out of the lake or river and drink it. And so cleansing and purifying. And then I started my time where I literally, the fall came and I stayed there, and the winter came and I stayed there. So I'm literally living outside by myself throughout the winter, and I bathed in the river until the day it froze. But anyway, this gives you an idea. But also, this was a spiritual time when I had to go out and really, you know, it was like purging of being around the devil is literally what it was like, in understanding the universe. And it's a connection that you have to make. And this is why I've said before that there are a lot of scientists who are good scientists. They get their bachelor's degree, then they go on, they get their master's or PhD, then they go out and get a job, and they're good scientists, but they'll never be great scientists because they never take the time, they never took the time to get out and understand and connect into the cosmos and get that mental and spiritual connection. You'll find that in the Bible or other places, you talk about people that went into the wilderness, and they spent typically they talk about 40 days in the wilderness. Well, 40 was the biblical term for many, more than you can remember. Like the Noah's flood, they say was 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, well, that's figurative. It's just a long time, so long that you can't remember how long it was. Or Christ going into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. Same thing. It's just a long time. And people have asked me, they said, well, how long do you have to go into the wilderness to cleanse your spirit and become have a spiritual connection to the universe? I said, if you have to ask that question, then you don't understand what it's all about. So I literally lived outside in central Canada. I did not have a tent. I did not have anything. I had no kind of roof. And finally, it was about February of 1982 when I finally came back to civilization, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But the whole experience of having to shed myself of being around these evil people and the evilness that was embedded in the science departments at Cornell was really important and to understand, and then get a handle on what I had done. Because at that point, I knew what I had done. I knew why I was right about everything I was doing, and that I was simply dealing with a corrupt science industry. And I'll be talking more about this also, because one of the next things I did was I came back to civilization and I got a job in the telecommunications industry, a very high level, high security job. And that provided me with a very nice income. And very soon after that, I was in Los Angeles looking for funding for my magnetic propulsion systems, which were part of understanding the electrical nature of the universe and the electrical and magnetic fields that then would be part of the basis for the magnetic propulsion systems. Okay, and there, that's where I met the families that run the military-industrial complex. I met these families in the venture capital groups in Los Angeles, which is another bed of snakes, if you want to call it that. But anyway, I'll be talking about that in a few minutes. But this incident where I was able to get out into the wilderness and spend a long, undetermined amount of time. But I just also want to reiterate that the day that I drove up and out of Ithaca was an extremely difficult day for me. I was alone. I was carrying this burden with me. My right arm was pretty much useless. And, you know, like I say, things were not going well. Not going well, and they should have been sending me into another realm but you know what I set out to accomplish, I accomplished. And other people have pointed out that if I would have stayed at Cornell, I wouldn't have the international notoriety probably that I have today. And because my audience is basically worldwide, and all of the other things that subsequently happened possibly would not have happened, and I would have been sequestered there and potentially never developed anything. So after I left, now I was able to, as an independent science, I was able to develop things and progress. And so anyway, it's one of those things that you don't know in life. If you took this road or that road, you don't know because you didn't take that road. That road was not available. So where would you be today? It's hard to say. But yeah, a very difficult time. And I needed that extra time in the Canadian wilderness to basically put all of this into perspective and to gain the other thing that happens is you become a warrior, and not the warrior with a sword. You become a warrior because you have such a large enemy that you have to overcome. And it takes a tremendous amount of spiritual prowess would be the proper term. And you find this throughout history. So my future then was to take this information directly to the public. The other thing I want to mention is the physical condition that I was in. When I came back to the real world, the modern world from Canada, I was in absolutely excellent, pristine condition, probably the best condition I'd ever been in my life. Because for me, physical activity was part of everyday existence. And also that pure environment, you probably couldn't find a more pure environment than Central Canada. And so, you know, eating fish, drinking the water directly from nature, which there's a lot of talk today about conditioning water. And, of course, what I sell are water filters. That's one of my businesses. But there's a lot of work being done on not only conditioning water, but understanding that pure water is much different than water that has all these chemicals in it. And the water structure itself, the actual structure of water is diminished greatly because of the pollutants in it. So if you get out of that environment in the food, the basic food that you need for sustenance is there. And by the way, let me just recount expeditions that went bad for example, to one of the polar expeditions where these men were trapped for months at a time out in the on these ice packs, and they had nothing to eat. And they were, from what I understand, they were with Eskimos, and the Eskimos would fish, and the Eskimos would eat the entire fish. They would cook it so they could eat the bones and everything, and they got complete nourishment from that. And so that's what was going on with me. I was getting complete nourishment and then cleansing my whole system with really pure water. And this gives you a period of time where your body is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And your mental condition, now your brain also, you know, modern science, if you can't put a meter on it and measure it, it doesn't exist. That's modern science. But the reality is that your brain connects to your spirit. That's the main connection point. And so does your heart, so do other organs in your body connect to the spirit that's living in your body. And if you don't know how to communicate with that spirit, I suggest you learn, because it's very much, I talk about this, I'm not going to talk about that today, but the purification of your body is very important in the spiritual sense. And if you're going to go out and meet a foe and encounter other new foes, which I was about to do, to meet the families that run the military-industrial complex of the world that overlap nations, that cause wars and make profit from it, I had to be spiritually set for that. And so anyway, the whole issue here is that I was very, very good physical condition. And literally, when I did come back to civilization, I went and I got a job at a high-tech company, telecommunications company. I'll talk about that in the future here. But as you might imagine, people that work in that environment are really not that healthy after years and years of working in that environment. You know, their muscle tone is weak. They're a little bit kind of like doughboy, pudgy on the, you know, and, you know, good engineers, good, you know, people, you know, at what they do professionally, but physically not in very good shape. And I walk in looking like a perfect, what a human being should look like. And so I'm not going to go into any more than that, but the really important aspect is the when you're in that pure condition, then your spirit also can connect into the basically the vertical electric field, and I've talked about that in my show, where you are outside, and the mining claim where I was had ridges, big peaks. And so I was able to get up on these, and that's where you connect into the vertical electric field. That's what they do in Peru when the Chirpas go up to very high altitudes, etc. They are purifying themselves, their bodies, etc., and then also going up higher where they get a much better connection into the vertical electric field, and that's very important to connect that the spiritual connection. And that's what the people, for example, all the masking and all the stay in your homes, etc., don't go out in groups, was preventing people from communicating spiritually. That is what it all is all about. That's the devil bringing in his ways of fear, of keeping people sequestered and apart and with masks on. That's what it was all about. It wasn't about health. They don't give a rat's behind about your health, believe me. It's all about sequestering the people into a slave state. And so anyway, I want to kind of talk about this at an extent because of the very great importance it was for me to coming back from Cornell to go into this purification state for a very long extended period of time. I also want to go back, I was talking about Dan Golden's response when asked by Tony Scarpelli, have you ever heard of James McCanney or his work? And also my reverse CIA agent who was then went into JPL and asked the same questions. And the way they responded was no comment. No comment. What does that really mean? Well, if I was wrong about everything I was doing, they would simply say, well, the guy's a nutcase. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's some kind of, you know, idiot. And by the time these questions were asked, I should have been long since forgotten. But clearly, I was front and center on the minds of these people, the head of NASA, scientists at JPL. I was on the very forefront, and they had direct orders, if ever confronted with any question about me, to say only no comment. This is like a military type of response. It's like when somebody is captured in a military scenario, they're told to only give their rank, name, and number, or something like that. So no comment, what does it mean? It means that they cannot negate what I'm doing, because if they really thought that I was just a nutcase and everything I did was wrong, they would easily just say, well, McCanny's a nutcase, you know. But they didn't. And so what does it say? It says that they know everything I'm doing is right, but they have to pretend, they have to live the lie. They have to live the lie, and they can't comment on it, because if they said, well, the truth, which McCanny is right about everything he's doing, then they would be complicit in agreeing with what I'm doing, and they can't do that either. So it's like checkmate. They can't say anything. The head of NASA, when asked about me and my work, only thing he could say was no comment. And then he turned and walked away. That tells you about everything you have to know, what I did during those 2 years at Cornell. And the effect that it had, now the Tony Scarpelli, Dan Golden thing, was in the early 2000s, probably around 2003. The other one, where the person went into JPL, was in a little bit later time frame. Anyway, I think it's important to understand this in context. What does no comment really mean? Okay, so this week I did a summary of the Cornell years. Next week I'll pick up on the confrontation that I had when I sent a sheet of paper. It was a one-pager. I sent it to the entire faculty of Cornell University, and I'm going to go through that and talk about that, and then move on into the future. What happened after I left Cornell, and maybe a few more anecdotes about living in Central Canada and purifying my body and spirit and connecting into the universal knowledge base, basically. And it's a connection. It's a feeling you have. It's your spirit connecting. And my mind opening up to eventually, for example, solving the prime number problem. But anyway, I will be talking to you next week. Once again, this is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.